Session number 9173, Reel 4.
John Redway, tape 4. Who was considered the leader of Ioka at this period? Would it have been Makarios or Grievous?
Well, I suppose Makarios was regarded as the overall leader because Ioka was part of the whole Enesis movement. It was the militant arm of the Enesis movement, and Grievous as his director of operations. That is a simplification, of course, of the relations between them, which were rather complicated. But there was no doubt about Makarios's role. He may have disagreed with Grievous from time to time over particular operations. He may have been relatively moderate as compared with this with Grievous, who, of course, was a notoriously brutal man. His record in Greece itself after the war, when he was in command of an extreme right organization, made it perfectly clear that he was an extremist and given to violence. Makarios may have had his difficulties with Grievous, certainly did, but there's no doubt that he was, organisationally speaking, in general charge of the whole thing. Doubts were raised about this during the time when the Harding-Makarios negotiations were going on. It was suggested, particularly here, I think, in England, that perhaps Makarios was not really directly responsible for the resort to violence. But when the first of the Grievous diaries were captured, it became perfectly clear. There he'd written about the Archbishop financing the purchase of arms. The Archbishop was the Yenikos, which is the general overall controller of the whole adventure, and there is no doubt whatsoever, I think, about Makarios's primary responsibility. And of course, with Papagos and Grievous in Athens, he had committed Greece and Cyprus and Greek Cyprus to violence, to the attempt to overthrow British rule and secure Enesis.
You indicated earlier that their relationship became very complicated. Is that for the reasons you've just outlined?
Grievous.
More to it than that.
Well, yes. Makarios, of course, had to conduct the struggle on the political plane, whereas Grievous was supposed to be working simply on the military terrorist plane. But Grievous was an extremely self-opinionated man who had very strong political opinions. From time to time, I'm sure he did fall out with Makarios over the degree and kind of violence to be used. Makarios himself may, in the end, I suppose, have regretted his choice in entrusting the military side of affairs to Grievous. But he got on the back of a tiger then, and it was difficult to get off. It was suggested that at the time of the negotiations, when they finally broke down over the Archbishop's insistence on things like a general amnesty and control of security within a short a period of time that Grievous had been behind him, in literally holding a pistol to his head. How true that is, I simply don't know.
You mentioned the Grievous diaries and how these implicated Makarios.
Yes.
Did you see them yourself? Because after all, you read Greek, didn't
you? Yes. Well, they brought the first first discovery. They'd been found in a place where Grievous had been hiding, and some British troops just by chance came across them, and they were put for safekeeping in large bottles, the sort of thing you would use for keeping preserved fruit or something like that. And they brought them. They brought them to me, I think, the day after they'd been discovered, and I read them through, and immediately on about page 3 or 4, under one's eyes was a statement that the Archbishop had provided so many thousand pounds for the purchase of arms. There were suggestions at the time that they were forgeries and so on. Absolutely untrue. There's no question of their authenticity. And indeed, Grievous, in his own memoirs, which were published afterwards in Greece, confirms their authenticity and confirms quite explicitly the role of the Archbishop.
Could I ask you now about the tripartite conference between Greece, Turkey and Britain in 1955, I think?
Yes.
And what the outcome of that was for the Cyprus situation?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to go back just a little bit earlier, perhaps to the summer of 1954, when the then Minister of State, the number two in the Colonial Office, made a statement in the House of Commons which was very severely criticised. They were debating Cyprus, and he said that, of course, we had to recognise that there were some colonies which could never expect to achieve independence. They were debating Cyprus, and the opposition had raised the question whether self-determination was not applicable to Cyprus, and this was the minister's reply. But he did go on to say that he wasn't going so far as that in today's debate, which was a sort of disclaimer that he was really denying self-determination for Cyprus for all time. But still, it was perfectly clear that the intention was to assert once again continued British sovereignty. Indeed, he said there was no question of a abrogation of British sovereignty. It was a mistake on his part to use that terrible word "never," which should never be used in politics. And afterwards, I think Churchill said in the House that the minister wasn't aware that he'd used the word in this impromptu debate. And Hopkinson himself did rephrase in rather less abrasive terms what he'd meant to say later on in that debate. However, it was picked up and intensified the criticism of Britain for maintaining the simple stand on sovereignty. In fact, of course, that position had become more and more untenable as the years went by, and decolonization was gathering pace elsewhere. And whatever we might say about no change in sovereignty in Cyprus, I think it's perfectly obvious that sometime it was some change was bound to come. Then the significance really in connection with self-determination of the 1955 conference was the fact that we had invited Greece and Turkey to discuss Cyprus. The conference was called on the basis of the mutual interests of the three powers in defence and other questions in the in the Eastern Mediterranean. And Cyprus was tacked on rather as a side issue or casual issue in the final phrase of the invitation, but it was perfectly obvious to everybody that Macmillan had called the conference in order to explore whether there was any common ground between Greece and Turkey and Britain over the future of Cyprus. And virtually the whole of the conference was taken up with a discussion of the Cyprus issue, the Greeks once again asserted their case for self-determination for Cyprus, leading, it was implied, of course, to Ennis's. The Turks insisted that self-determination was not of universal application, that there were cases where it had had to be modified or restricted, and that in any case, Turkey simply was not prepared to accept the case for the Greek Cypriot majority to decide the future of the island, that it had its legitimate, that Turkey had its legitimate interests in Cyprus, for defence, for the defence of the southern coast of Turkey, and also because of the presence of the Turkish Cypriots, for whom Turkey felt it had a responsibility. the British proposed, in the face of this deadlock, they said, well, let's leave the question of the final status of the island up in the air, and now you, Greece and Turkey, cooperate with us in developing a form of self-government for the island. But that was not acceptable to either of the other parties. Under pressure, the British delegation, under pressure from the Turks, the British delegation did go on record as saying that they agreed that self-determination was not a principle of universal application. So to that extent, they sided with Turkey against Greece on that issue, but rather reluctantly. So the meeting broke up in deadlock. The British put forward some some summary proposals about the form self-government might take, but neither of the other powers was prepared to pursue that. It's been said that I think Nancy Crawshaw says that the conference ended in catastrophe, and it is true that it had the effect of exacerbating relations between Greece and Turkey. But I think perhaps that goes a bit too far, because I would look on it now, with looking at, back at it, as the first step in a very necessary process of trying to bring Greece and Turkey together, and Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots together, to see whether there was any possibility of a modus vivendi, a compromise on the future of the island, and at least an educational process to try and get them to understand that each had legitimate rights and interests which would have to be accommodated in any final solution. So although the immediate results were damaging, I think it was a part of a necessary process. The significance of it for Britain, of course, and our attitude to self-determination was that we had virtually recognised the legitimacy of the Greek and Turkish interests in Cyprus, and so we could never then revert to the earlier simple but untenable position that there was nothing to discuss, that British sovereignty should remain, and that was that. So from that time on, we were faced with the necessity of tackling this, of grappling with this basic issue of sovereignty, the final status and the application of self-determination.
What was the immediate result of that conference in Cyprus itself? You know, was there an increase in the violence after that, the deadlock at that conference?
Not noticeably. I don't think it had all that much impact within Cyprus. I think the Greeks dismissed it as an obvious ploy by the British to try and play off Turkey against Greece, and the collapse of the conference was predictable. The Turks simply, again, that it had demonstrated the intransigence of the Greek side, and had perhaps even done some good in giving Turkey an opportunity to state its case on the international plane.
You mentioned the great change in the situation when you returned to Cyprus in 1955. Did it continue to deteriorate the situation throughout 1955? I was wondering what were the circumstances which led to the appointment of Field Marshal Harding as governor.
Yes. Well, certainly the whole situation did deteriorate very sharply indeed during the from the outbreak of violence at the beginning of April until September, whenever it was, when the change in governors occurred. And towards the end, I think there'd been a very serious riot in Nicosia, with young Greeks breaking into the British Council offices and burning all the books and all that, and this had made the British authorities appear insecure and indeed perhaps incapable, so the government in London decided that they had to put a strong governor with a military background in charge, and the Field Marshal was appointed.
Before I ask you about the Field Marshal, could I ask you about Sir Robert Armitage, who would have been the governor during this period, 1955, and how he was coping with the situation? I believe he also was working with John Fletcher Cook, who would have been his chief of the secretary.
His colonial secretary, yes.
How was that team sort of coping with things?
Well, I suppose one would have to say not very well once the violence had broken out. It had tended to take the administration to some extent by surprise, and we were not really very well equipped to at that time to deal with such an outbreak. Armitage's background, he'd been financial secretary in one of the larger West African colonies. He was an extremely competent civil servant, a very likable a man, and had worked hard on the economic on the side of economic development for Cyprus during the short time that that he was there, but he didn't have any background in the peculiar circumstances of the peculiar history of Cyprus, and perhaps never got a very good grasp of the problem. I would say that went that was true also of his colonial secretary, Fletcher Cook.
Yes.
He had served in Malaya before and had had the dreadful experience of living in a Japanese war camp, prisoner of war camp. Then he'd been in London for a spell in the colonial office and came to Cyprus. I think he regarded Cyprus as just another colonial problem and perhaps as another stage in his own career in the colonial service. I think he was rather insensitive to the local situation. Certainly, he didn't get on particularly well with the Cypriots, and that, of course, was important if one was going to understand what was going on. He was perhaps a bit narrow-minded in his whole approach, and probably took a rather cynical view that the whole Cyprus problem was insoluble anyway, and so there was nothing very much one could do about it except try to maintain law and order and get on as best one could with the economic and social development of the island. He was certainly a very competent a civil servant, but at that stage Cyprus really needed understanding of the underlying nature of the problem.
To your knowledge, had Sir Robert Armitage requested more troops from the British government?
That is not something that I can speak of with personal knowledge. I think I was Secretary for Communications and Works or something like something like that at the time, and was not concerned with the political or defence side. I'm sure, however, that it must be true that he had, when faced with the outbreak of violence, he must have sought further military support.
Was any forthcoming before Lord Hardinge's appointment?
Yes, there had been an increase in the number of troops there, but of course it was from a very minimal base, and they had appointed a brigadier as a director of security. But that was about the limit of it, and certainly once the Field Marshal arrived, much greater military support was quickly forthcoming.
Do you think his appointment, the appointment of Field Marshal Hardinge, was a sign of the British government's awareness of the seriousness of the Cyprus situation?
I think without doubt that they had decided that things were going to get worse, and that although the solution to the problem had to be sought on the political plane, nevertheless, it was essential to not to allow terrorism to succeed. And the Field Marshal, I should have thought, seemed to ministers in London an ideal choice for the job. He was by no means the simple soldier that the brutal soldier that Greek Cypriot propaganda made him out to be. He was extremely astute politically, as well, of course, as being a magnificent soldier.
What was your relationship with the Field Marshal? You know, when he arrived in Cyprus, I think it was September 1955,
yes.
Was it, or October? Were you still in charge of the sort of development that you've described? Or?
Something like that, I think. And then I was appointed as Assistant Administrative Secretary That was a bit later, yes. No, at that stage, I was, on the day after his arrival, I think, I was summoned to Government House to talk to him about the situation, and Fletcher Cook was there then as Colonial Secretary, and I spoke a little about the necessity to tackle the core of the problem, the question of final status, reality of the inescapable reality of the national aspirations of the Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots, which somehow sooner or later would have to be accommodated. I got the impression that this didn't go down particularly well with, I knew it wouldn't go down particularly well with Fletcher Cook. I wasn't sure whether it had any impact on the Field Marshal, and it was some weeks later that he brought me over onto the political side. That was after the appointment of George Sinclair as deputy governor. The post of Colonial Secretary had been abolished. Fletcher Cook had gone. And then I got on terms very quickly with George Sinclair. I think we saw pretty much eye to eye in many, many ways. And so I was brought over onto the political side as Deputy Administrative Secretary.
Were many changes made to the organisation of the administration, you know, the various branches, the civil administration and its relationship with the security and the police in particular?
Yes. Well, the sort of technical departments continued as before, and so the civil administration, so to speak, except for the police, continued very much as before. George Sinclair was brought in to supervise under the Field Marshal the civil administration and to free the Field Marshal to give more time to the military defence security aspects, and also to the conduct of the political and negotiations at a high level. The marked difference that occurred was the establishment of a director of operation of security who controlled the police as well as the army there, working very closely with George Sinclair as well as the Field Marshal.